On behalf of the Penn Library, I want to welcome you all this evening to yet another program on the life and legends of Benjamin Franklin, and this the year of his tercentenary of his birth. The tercentenary of Franklin has been a time both of celebration and toasting, but also an opportunity for some critical reappraisals and reassessments of Franklin the man, Franklin the myth. Nobody encourages us more to see him as a myth than Franklin himself, which is why we welcome and cherish these opportunities to actually get beneath the myth. The context for the program this evening, the exhibit that you see around you, is part of the library's attempt to, in fact, create a proper historical setting for evaluating Franklin's ideas of education and Franklin's achievement in creating the College of Philadelphia, which became the University of Pennsylvania. Philadelphia, as an outsider, is a really hard place to get to know. I remember coming here from California some 14 years ago and finding it a very strange and resistant place. It resists being known, it resists being discovered. At least this was my view. It was private, quiet, reserved, and a bit eccentric. However, it was a place that over the years I've come to get to know and appreciate, its privacy and its concern for its individuality and idiosyncrasies. Only in Philadelphia would the Barnes Foundation be considered normal. And two people in particular helped me really come to understand and appreciate Philadelphia, its history, and its traditions. One is no longer with us, and that was the great sociologist Digby Baltzel, whom I was privileged to meet and work with a little bit towards the end of his life. Digby, of course, had all of the great theories on Philadelphia and why it was the way it was. But the other person who really played an important role in my life, both professionally and personally, in helping orient me to Philadelphia and the richness of the city, and of course the richness of the university and its traditions, is our speaker this evening, who has proved to be, over the years, a most gracious and a most generous friend and observer of the scene. Somebody who's taught me an enormous amount about both Penn and Philadelphia and how Penn and Philadelphia relate to each other. Our speaker this evening has a wealth of experience in the field of archives and management, but even more so in terms of the historic preservation of the record of our area here, as rich as it is. Nobody knows where the bodies are better than our speaker this evening. Nobody knows more about the history of the university and its traditions and its sources than our speaker this evening, who, in addition to having been university archivist for more than two decades now, also teaches in Penn's history department, where he has introduced generations of undergraduates to primary sources in American history. It's my pleasure and my very warm pleasure to present this evening Mark Fraser Lloyd, archivist of the University of Pennsylvania, who will be speaking this evening on Franklin's idea of the English school, proposed and defended. Mark.
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm delighted that introduction was recorded, and I hope it appears on the website along with what I have to say. Thank you very much, Michael. And thanks also to John Pollock for this wonderful exhibition that's around us. I saw several of you looking at it before we sat down, and it's really worth spending some time with. I urge all of you afterwards to spend as much time with it as you can before my friend Carton Rogers asks all of us to leave for the evening. I brought with me a handout that I'd like to ask a couple of volunteers who are seated near the front to help me distribute.
I should say, too, just that there will be refreshments and libations afterwards if you want to say, look at the exhibit, talk to Mark, and talk about it. Thank you, Ms. Franklin.
If those are not enough, I still have some more. Did we have enough? Good. I thought I'd start not with the handout, but with the verdict that was pronounced on Franklin by the historian of the University of Pennsylvania in 1940. He was Edward Potts Cheney and had been on the faculty here for his entire lifetime and was asked to write the university's bicentennial history. And if you read that, you'll find that it's a really well-nuanced and thoughtful history of the university. It's still the first book that I turn to when I'm interested in finding a particular nugget about one aspect of the university history or another. So let me read just briefly from it to give you some idea of how he saw Franklin and Franklin's ideas about education. Just what were Franklin's ideas with respect to education, it is hard to discover. For those in the proposals of 1749 were a compromise between his own and those of others. As he tells us in regard to the proposed curriculum, quote, Mr. Allen, Mr. Francis, Mr. Peters, and some other persons of wealth and learning, whose subscriptions and countenances we should need, being of the opinion that it should include the learned languages, I submitted my judgment to theirs. End quotation. His account of the Academy, laid before City Council in 1750, and his idea of the English school, published in 1751, had the same practical object. His views expressed in his observations 40 years later bear the evident marks of bitterness and conflict. His main ideas, however, are pretty clear. He would have had an education utilitarian rather than cultural, entirely in the English language, though following the best models in that language, devoting much attention to training in thought and expression. It would include mathematics, geography, history, logic, and natural and moral philosophy. It should be an education for citizenship and should lead to mercantile and civic success and usefulness. It is unfortunate that it was never tried. Well, tonight we're going to try it. And what you have in front of you should help allow us to do that. There is a progression of events that Franklin participated in and which are documented on this wonderful website that Michael and I and others in the room have helped put together. I would draw your attention to the first item, proposals relating to the education of youth in Pennsylvania. The fourth item, constitutions of the public academy. The seventh item, a sermon on education. The eighth item, idea of the English school. And on the second page, the third item, a view of the Latin, Greek, and philosophy schools at the College of Philadelphia. And on the third page, the 10th item, called Observations Relative to the Intentions of the Original Founders of the Academy in Philadelphia. The observations are a relatively unknown piece of Franklin's writing, partly because they haven't been published yet in the papers of Benjamin Franklin. That series not quite complete, and still a few years short of the time that this observations piece was written. But it seems to me that while others may call it angry and vindictive or bitter and full of conflict, I see it as a primary source that should be used to its full utility. And we're going to do that here in a few minutes. But first, an outline of the events that I wanted to share with you. In 1749, Franklin wrote his proposals, which called for a rector of the academy whose chief skills be in the teaching of English. The constitutions, on the other hand, called for an academy for teaching the Latin and Greek languages, the English tongue grammatically and as a language, and the most useful living foreign languages, French, German, and Spanish. 2 years later, the academy opened with a faculty of three. The rector of the academy was also the master of the Latin school. His name was David Martin. The master of the English school was David James Dove, and the master of the mathematical school was Theophilus Grew, a wonderful 18th century name. When they used the term school, they meant little more than a classroom. And it's important for you to keep that in mind, very, very different from what we think of as a school in the university today. In 1755, the academy had a charter change that converted it to a college. And the college curriculum is set forth on that document that's on page 2 of the draft that I've distributed. In 1756, however, Franklin missed the first 5 meetings of the trustees that year. And in the balloting that was taken in May of 1756, he was voted out as president of the College of Philadelphia. This is little discussed here at Penn today for obvious reasons. But his ouster is a part of the historical record and is something that we all should weigh as we think a little bit about what he had to say in 1789. But as early as 1759, writing from England to a friend here in Philadelphia, Franklin's assessment was as follows. Quote, "Before I left Philadelphia, everything to be done in the academy was privately preconcerted in a cabal, without my knowledge or participation, and accordingly carried into execution. The schemes of public party made it seem requisite to lessen my influence wherever it could be lessened. The trustees had reaped the full advantage of my head, hands, heart, and purse in getting through the first difficulties of the design. And when they thought they could do without me, they laid me aside. I wish success to the schools nevertheless, and am sorry to hear that the whole number of scholars does not at present exceed 140. End quotation. Franklin's view in 1759 was fairly accurate. The politics of Pennsylvania, as a result of the Seven Years' War, had placed him on an opposite side from most of those who were trustees of the college. That's a different story for a different occasion. I won't go into it in detail at all tonight. But Franklin ended up on the other side of the political spectrum from many of the people who had been his allies in establishing the academy just 5 or 6 years earlier. By 1789, Franklin's assessment had not changed very much. And I'd like to quote to you briefly from some of his work in the Observations, which is on that list that I distributed. Franklin wrote, quote, "It is to be observed in this place that here are two distinct courses in the same study, that is, of the same branches of science, history, geography, chronology, logic, and oratory, to be carried on at the same time, but not by the same tutor or master. The English master is to teach his scholars all those branches of science, and also the English tongue, grammatically and as a language. The Latin master is to teach the same sciences to his boys, beside the Greek and Latin. We shall see hereafter how easily this original plan was defeated and departed from." The first instance of partiality in favor of the Latin part of the institution was in giving the title of rector to the Latin master and no title to the English master. But the most striking instance was when we met to sign the constitutions, the votes of a majority carried it to give twice as much salary to the Latin master as to the English, and yet require twice as much duty from the English master as from the Latin. That is, 200 pounds salary to the Latin master to teach 20 boys, 100 pounds salary to the English master to teach 40. Franklin listed in his observations additional instances of imbalance, either voted directly by the trustees or simply tolerated by them. The first was that purchases of books for the academy included Latin and Greek texts, but no English books whatsoever. Another was that the first English master had been very successful, David James Dove, but he resigned in 1753 in a conflict over work hours, and the master who was hired to replace him, Ebenezer Kinnersley, was not so successful. In Franklin's words, Kinnersley, quote, "though a good man, yet not possessing the talents of an English schoolmaster in the same perfection as Mr. Dove, the school diminished daily and soon was found to have but about 40 scholars left," end quotation. By 1763, 10 years later, the full effect of the diminution of the school, the English school, was felt by the trustees themselves. The state of the English school was taken into consideration. This is at a meeting of the trustees in February of 1763. It was observed that Mr. Kinnersley's time was entirely taken up in teaching little boys the elements of the English language, and that speaking and rehearsing in public were totally disused, to the great prejudice of the other scholars and students, and contrary to the original design of the trustees in forming of that school. And as this was a matter of great importance, it was particularly recommended to be fully considered by the trustees at their next meeting. At their next meeting, however, there was no consideration. The English education had indeed been neglected, and in Franklin's word, the 1 minute that I've just read was a full acknowledgement that the conduct of the English school was contrary to the original design of the trustees in forming it. Franklin himself took responsibility, at least in part, for this. At the end of his observations, he says the following, "I am the only one of the original trustees now living, and I am just stepping into the grave myself. I am afraid that some part of the blame incurred by the trustees may be laid on me for having too easily submitted to the deviations from the Constitution and not opposing them with sufficient zeal and earnestness. Though indeed my absence in foreign countries at different times for nearly 30 years tended much to weaken my influence. To make what amends are yet in my power, I seize this opportunity, the last I may possibly have, of bearing testimony against those deviations. It seems to me that Franklin's observations are not properly characterized when they're called angry or bitter or full of conflict. In fact, this is pretty level-headed thinking, a level-headed argument that we should take very seriously when we review what happened to his idea of an English school. So let's take a few minutes and do that. If you'll take the clip off this handout and turn to page 4, you'll find a printed copy straight from the SETI website of the idea of the English school. And if you thumb through it quickly, you'll see that there are 6 classes altogether, and there are several things that I want to comment about those. Notice that he says at the very beginning that every scholar admitted to this school be at least able to pronounce and divide the syllables in reading and to write a legible hand. None to be received that are under, and there's a blank, years of age. Now, who wants to venture from the audience how old a student this would be in contemporary terms? At what level, what grade do we teach these rudiments of education? Yes.
7 or 8.
2nd grade, 3rd grade?
6.
That sounds about right. I learned how to read in 2nd grade and spent a lot of time in 3rd grade getting better at it. And I think that that's what Franklin had in mind here, that the first class in his school would be at about the 4th grade level. And he says right at the outset, let the first class learn the English grammar rules, and at the same time let particular care be taken to improve them in orthography. Spelling, which was the bane of many of us in grammar school, was very important to Franklin, and he sets that out in the very first sentence of his very first class. Turn to the next page and note that Franklin has some ideas about what should be read. Let the pieces read by the scholars in this class be short, such as Croxall's fables and little stories. None of us today, or only a very few of us, know anything about Samuel Croxall, but he wrote Fables of Aesop and Others, published in London in 1722 with many later editions. In fact, it went into reprints until early in the 20th century, an enormously popular work. Franklin knew exactly what he was doing in recommending it. Turn to the second class. Let's work our way through this document. And think of it in terms of about the 5th grade in present-day schooling. Reading with attention and with proper modulations of the voice according to the sentiments and subject. Some short pieces not exceeding the length of a spectator to be given. The spectator had influenced Franklin deeply earlier in his life. It was a British periodical that revolutionized periodical literature in Great Britain when it came out in 1711 and 1712. Its influence really can't be overestimated in my view. The Spectator was primarily written by 2 men, Joseph Addison and Richard Steele, and they published essay after essay, some 550 of them, in little less than 2 years' time. And these essays were so well received, so good, that they were read for years and decades afterwards. Franklin, who organized the Junto early in his adult life, he was just 21 or 22 when he did so, recommended the Spectator to his fellow members and read it himself as a young man to improve his own abilities. And so here he is recommending it for his English school, and I wanted you to know a little bit about what the Spectator is. Turn to the next page, page 3 at the top, and note what he says about the English master. The master then to read the piece with the proper modulations of voice, due emphasis, and suitable action where action is required, and put the youth on imitating his manner. In other words, the whole business of public speaking and oratory was taken into consideration by Franklin early on, a very important part of what he thought a public person should master and have available in his repertoire of skills. Drop your eye down that page a little bit, and you'll see that he recommended that the youngsters have an English dictionary to help them over difficulties, another book that all of us acquire sometime around the fifth or the sixth grade, if I remember correctly. Turn the page to the third class, and notice what he recommends there in the second paragraph. For their farther improvement, and a little to vary their studies, let them now begin to read history, after having got by heart a short table of the principal epochs in chronology. They may begin with Rollin's Ancient and Roman Histories and proceed at proper hours as they go through the subsequent classes. Rollin's histories were unknown to me before I first read this, but they were enormously popular in Great Britain. The full title of the history was The Ancient History of the Egyptians, Carthaginians, Assyrians, Babylonians, Medes and Persians, Macedonians, and Cretans, published in 10 volumes, 1738 to 1740. A real magnum opus, if you ask me. I don't expect that Franklin thought that the students were going to read all 10 volumes, but selections obviously from it. Turn the page to the fourth class. There you will see that he emphasizes writing, composition, he calls it. Writing one's own language well is the next necessary accomplishment after good speaking. And so, at about the grade of seventh grade or eighth grade, by modern comparison, he's having the students write at length and become good writers. Again, this sounds very familiar to me, and I'm sure recognized by most of you in the audience. On the next page, he describes some of the texts that will lead the students in better writing. Letters by Sir William Temple and Dr. Johnson's First Principles of Morality, which he recommended in particular to lay a solid foundation of virtue and piety in their minds. Johnson, in a footnote, I should mention, had been Franklin's first choice to head the academy. And Franklin was very disappointed when he could not enlist him in the academy. And as a result of that, the academy opened with a different group of masters, none of them nearly so prominent as this person from Connecticut, Samuel Johnson. The fifth class, you'll note, considers improving the youth in composition further. Besides continuing to write letters, begin to write little essays in prose and sometimes in verse. Not to make them poets, but for this reason, that nothing acquaints a lad so speedily with a variety of expression as the necessity of finding such words and phrases as will suit with the measure, sound, and rhyme of verse. Very, I think, instructive comment on Franklin's part, and one that I remember very well in trying to wade through my first instances of poetry somewhere in junior high, or what they call middle school now. Finally, turn to the last page and to the sixth class. There you will see a series of writers that sound like a modern-day liberal arts curriculum. In this class, it seems as though he has addressed what he thinks students should be doing at the age of 15 or 18. He talks about the studies of history, rhetoric, logic, moral, and natural philosophy, and the best English authors read and explained. Tillotson, Milton, Locke, Addison, Pope, Swift, the higher papers in The Spectator and Guardian, the best translations of Homer, Virgil, Horace, of Telemachus, Travels of Cyrus, etc. That's quite a run of really first-rate works. And it reads to me like an English major with a minor in the classics. I would hope that most of you could see how that does in fact reflect education even today in the 21st century. Finally, he says, thus instructed, and this is a great phrase of his on page 8, thus instructed, youth will come out of this school fitted for learning any business, calling, or profession, except such where languages are required. And though unacquainted with any ancient or foreign tongue, they will be masters of their own, which is of more immediate and general use, and withal will have attained many other valuable accomplishments. The time usually spent in acquiring those languages, often without success, being here employed in laying such a foundation of knowledge and ability as, properly improved, may qualify them to pass through and execute the several offices of civil life with advantage and reputation to themselves and country. That sounds to me like the grand aim of a liberal education. And yet, you couldn't get that kind of an education at Penn for 150 years after Franklin wrote that passage. Not until 1852 did Penn confer Bachelor of Science degrees, and when that was introduced, the provost was so upset he resigned his job and went to a different university to teach where only the classics were part of the curriculum. And unless you took Latin and Greek, you couldn't get the Bachelor of Arts degree at Penn until 1914, in which case the faculty relented and allowed that you could take Latin or Greek. And it wasn't until 1930, finally, that Penn awarded the Bachelor of Arts degree for the modern liberal arts curriculum, the one that I think Franklin introduced in his idea of an English school. Thank you very much. I think it was the other trustees, those who saw the academy as a place to raise up their sons for entry into a traditional English college or professional school. Several of them, William Allen, Benjamin Chu, and others, did exactly that. After their sons graduated from the academy or the fledgling college, they immediately sent them overseas to receive the finishing education, only to bring them back here for professional life. So I think that that was the principal objection that Franklin met when he tried to introduce these ideas. Anything else? Any other questions? Comments? Yes.
In the observations at the end of his life, he seems really to focus on this problem of the academy level of the school and how that was or wasn't run. And not to say so much about the college level. Do you think that is his opinion of what went wrong at the academy?
Well, the college was the child of William Smith. Smith introduced it, Smith taught it, Smith led it for 25 years. And Franklin conflicted with Smith, as you know, over politics, though Smith had been his protege originally. I think that Franklin hoped that the English school could be on an equal plane with the college as he knew it, and that he just used academy to refer to both.
I think one of the interesting things that we have sort of brought to the attention of the Penn community again through this exhibit is the fact that really the origins of the institution really are in primary school education, and that was Franklin's first and foremost concern, and that with the opening or the re-entry of Penn into the business of primary schooling, Penn in fact returns, probably without anybody in College Hall knowing it.
I hope you've all learned a little bit more about Franklin. Thank you.